Welcome. Thank you for joining us. We are back after a week away. This is Life in Jiu-Jitsu. I am your host, Gibran Maciel. And if you don't like it, well, I'm the only host you got for this particular endeavor. We are live today. Actually, we're not actually live. We're going to throw it up on Facebook later, but say we're live.
Even better.
Whatever. With Johnny Spicy Go. Johnny, how'd you get the nickname?
Spicy Johnny? I actually got it at a sushi restaurant. We went out to eat as a jiu-jitsu group. And I actually really didn't know much about sushi. And so I just saw a spicy Johnny roll and I was like, oh, I ordered that. And then so my instructor, Mario Cerezo, he's like, oh, spicy Johnny, I like that. And then it added to it because I would wear since white belt, I would wear a red gi because the thinking for me was if I wear this gi, people will like attack me and
that'll get better. Like a bull or something.
Yeah, exactly. You know, I was like, if this is a super obnoxious gi, so if I wear this, people will
come after the guy in the white in the red gi.
Exactly. And then so
where'd you even find a red gi?
It was a corral. Yeah, the corral made these red gis, and they were a little bit expensive, but I
worth every penny.
Absolutely. I had to buy it twice because the first one got stolen. But yeah, that happened a lot around Brutta's because it's on Rio Lindo, like Watt in Rio Lindo or whatever. It's not in a good part of town.
Oh shit.
Yeah.
I just saw someone, Zach Felkins, was it Zach, I think, put out like, he has an academy in Rio Lindo and he has like a, like an American flag outside the academy.
Oh, yes.
And he's like, someone stole the flag.
Oh, yeah.
He's like, thank you. He's like, thank you, Rio Lindo, for...
Oh, God. I didn't realize that happened. Yeah. Jeez. Yeah.
I think it was either Zach or somebody else.
Oh, yeah.
Put that out there. But, dude, my first like 6 years, I'd never bought like a new gi. They were all like Craigslist gis.
Oh, nice.
You know, I figured I had this like... it was like a point of pride. I had this theory that also probably because I grew up, you know, not poor, but, you know, working class.
Right.
And so I kind of had this theory, like if I would buy like the fancy new shit right away, maybe I won't try as hard. Like I wanted to like be hungry. You know what I mean? I wanted to be like that, like street fighter with like a borrowed gi or whatever. Yeah. You know? So
that's legit.
I'd go online and like look for people that were like quitting jits basically and like like buy their gis off of them. And I said to myself, I'm going to be stronger than this guy. You know, I'm not going to quit. You know, he's like, I'm buying a gi off of the version of me that could have been, but I'm going to persevere.
You absorb their power.
Yeah. It's like true. Highlander, like when they fucking decapitate the other Highlander, yeah, you take their power, you know,
it's like taking ears, you know,
you know, what is like Highlander actually? As I do the podcast, I'm starting to learn more about like audio and video editing. Like fight hype, you know, like when Holly Holm decapitated Ronda Rousey,
yes,
with that shin kick to the neck and the head.
Yeah.
There was like, you could almost see the bolt of lightning coming from the heavens. Like Holm was like absorbing all of Ronda's hype,
right?
You know, it's like, when like TJ Dillashaw, like, you know. When TJ Dillashaw like knocked Barat out, you could just see it like TJ Shaw just like, it's like Space Jam where they like, came down from another planet and took all their mojo, you know?
Right. Yeah.
Like that's what's really pure about, I think, about MMA in particular. Boxing does a lot more to, I think, protect their golden boys.
Right.
But what's really pure about MMA in particular, I think, is like, there isn't that sense of like protecting the golden boy as much as there is in boxing. It's just like, nah, you're gonna, this is Highlander, you know?
Yeah.
Like we're fighting for each other's mortal souls.
It is so much more final, right? Like it's not like in boxing you could be like, well, if this was a real fight or something, you know, there's no extra level to MMA. You can't be like, well, you know, I think it's Joe Rogan, right, who said that whole thing. He compared it to like in basketball, you lose in basketball and it's like, okay, well, I could beat that guy up or whatever.
Right.
And
then
in MMA, it's like, okay, what's the next after that? We already fought, you know, like you lost. And then I think you're right. That's why you absorb. Like I was going to say when Rampage knocked out Liddell, because that was when like nobody knew about the Pride guys, and everyone was like, yeah, UFC, Chuck Liddell, you know, the Iceman and all that. And no one really knew.
Liddell was like the first guy to like really go big with the, the MMA thing.
Yeah. Yeah. He was the first, like the, I think he was the first guy where people who didn't know like mixed martial arts or jiu-jitsu like could recognize him. Like my buddy who didn't like jiu-jitsu at all, or didn't train it or whatever, he like knew about Chuck Liddell and like loved Chuck Liddell and loved all that stuff, you know. And like he was I feel like he was the first star in MMA.
Because he looked like a guy that would get off his motorbike and beat your ass. He looked like that Sons of Anarchy character,
some
like
Mad Max fool.
Like coming off the fucking
witness
dune
me.
No, he's that guy, right?
Yeah,
he's definitely that guy.
Yeah, know? He probably still is. Shit.
Yeah. You know, I heard a lot of those guys. Chuck, if you're out there, you're invited on the show.
Yeah,
you know, to respond to the allegations.
Yeah.
But no, you know, I heard a lot of those guys, like, it's tough for them. It's like after being, you know, the world champion of the UFC, you're just kind of almost akin to like soldiers coming back home from war. Nothing is quite as exciting.
Right.
You know, I had a roommate who came back after 3 tours in Afghanistan and 2 in Iraq.
Yeah,
he's not with us anymore, unfortunately.
Oh, jeez.
And just to quickly say, we have to do better for these guys coming home, because, you know, we let those guys kind of flounder on their own. So Mikhail Vinnikov is doing some great work on that front. But anyways, you know, he was telling me, like, there's just kind of, like, something kind of even exciting about a fight, like kind of weirdly intoxicating about, you know, almost losing your life.
Yep.
And just kind of nothing. And so I met him at Ultimate Fitness, and he was a fighter. And that was like the closest he could get.
What do you mean? The
closest he could get to that sense of combat,
of course.
You know, he talked to me. He's like, you know, when, like after a good sparring session or after a fight, he says, especially after a fight, like you go out into the parking lot and the air just kind of chills over you, and you get these like goosebumps on your skin, and you know, you just kind of feel like rejuvenated a little bit, almost in a weird way.
Yeah.
And he's like, I just can't. And he's like, what do you want me to do? Like, you want me to go like man a desk?
Yeah.
He's like, I'm not going to do that.
Yeah. Yeah.
He's
no.
Like, I'm not going to fucking do that.
No. I mean, you're a drug addict at that point, you know, like whether you know it or not, like there's, I remember my first loss and my first win, and it was just like the emotional effects it had on my body. Like I don't think, like I've never been so like happy, and I've never been so devastated, you know.
Really?
Like, just in the moment, like it was just like my first fight I lost, it sucked because like I got the guy in an arm bar in the first round really quick. And then like, apparently he kneed me in the head, or the ref thought he kneed me in the head while I had the arm bar locked, and he stood us up and everyone thought I won. I thought I won for a second. And then he's like, he kneed you in the head. Da, da, da. And then,
you were underneath him with an arm bar, like from guard or something.
Yeah,
like that.
Exactly.
And he, his response was perhaps to knee you in the head while you were down. And the ref's response was like,
stand him up.
That's ridiculous.
Yeah. Well, this is
that's terrible.
Yeah. And this was back. He was
before people knew better.
Exactly. Yeah. It was even a freaking rodeo, you know, like we were in a rodeo in Woodland.
You're fighting on the dirt.
Yeah. Like, you know, and so it was just like half of the audience was the Norteños, you know, and like, so it was just kind of like where, you know, and it was my first, there was no amateur to go to like when I started. So you just
fought at the rodeo.
Yeah. I just fought at the rodeo. And, anyways, like, yeah, the guy was a good wrestler. So like after he was like, oh, okay, this guy has some ground. Like he
nullified it.
Yeah. Like locked me up, and I got really conservative too. And like, and then, you know, I lost a decision. And then just like the next day it was just like, man, I felt so sad. I think I just sad. Just like it was like I needed to go back to the gym, you know, like just like it, just try to get it. The only other time I've kind of felt like that is like breakups and stuff, you know.
Yeah,
but those are harder because it's like in a way, because it's like you can't train it away. You can't get the, you know, no, yeah. Yeah. But you know, but
they,
yeah.
Yeah. You know, they say the best revenge is to live well.
Yeah, there you go. Well,
that's really all.
Well, then to all my exes, I think I'm doing pretty well. Living pretty good.
Yeah. But that's all you can do.
Yeah, I think so. You know? Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, well, there's I think the problem with that sort of thing, as it, you know, as the way that, you know, fighting is a very tangible thing, right? Like, you can shore up your boxing defense, or you can shore up your technical attributes, but there's certain, you know, there's certain characteristics that are more difficult to shore up, both in life and in fighting, right? Like, it's hard to become more enduring in difficult situations if you're just not that good at being the anvil instead of the right. hammer. Like, it's hard to shore up your grit. Like, it's right. almost seems like you're kind of, you know, born with a certain amount of grit, and you know what you can do is you can keep your composure, so you don't have to lose your composure and rely solely on grit. But there's I believe there's just a certain amount of grit that some people have, and that's kind of not really up for negotiation.
Right. You know? I understand.
Same with fight IQ. Uh-huh. You know, and like your ability to read other people's people's rhythms and movements and stuff like that. And,
right.
and then more broadly, like in, you know, being rejected interpersonally, that's a hard thing to shore up, right? Like, one, do you even want to be the type of person that ex wants?
Right.
You know, can you even, you know, or are you just walking down different paths?
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Breakups can fuck with your head.
Oh yeah.
Breakups can definitely fuck with your head. Like, what doesn't that person, why doesn't that person want me? You know?
Right. Yeah. But,
I don't know. I think oftentimes it's kind of like it's a good thing, and people don't even realize. I have a buddy out there. I won't say his name, but he just got. He's not super good looking, and he's kind of down on himself. Probably smokes a little too much weed.
Okay.
Yeah, and
sounds like a lot of people in Davis.
Yeah. And, you know, he's a fun guy. I'm really endeared to him. You know, but he just got dumped, and he's taking it you know, roughly.
Yeah.
I was like, you know, there's no way for you to go back to the gym and shore that up, just right. like you said. You know what I mean? Yeah. You're just not tall enough or good looking enough, or maybe interpersonally just don't interact with other. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And then as you get older, what's so gnarly about it with interpersonal relationships is that people start getting closer to that age where they want to marry and look for someone that they want to you know, be with forever.
Right.
And then you start getting into like the real like business. You know, like the real business of picking a mate, and they're like, well, you know,
it is a business.
That girl was like looking for someone who makes more money, I think.
Yeah.
Or like, oh, that girl was looking, you know, it's really important for that guy to be with a mate that's like really socially connected and happening and about town. And maybe that's just never me, you know?
Right.
And so you sort of, people start like taking it as if it's like something against them, where it's really just people looking for different things.
You know what I mean? Yeah, totally.
But you know,
it's
so much different than getting your ass whooped fighting. Yeah. You just got your ass whooped.
Yeah, I'd probably take an ass whooping over over a breakup, because you can heal. My instructor, Mario Cerezo, he was big on this, it's a Greek word, agape, right?
Okay.
And he's talking about grit, and he's always used this word agape, and it's like, the willingness to suffer, you know, mm-hmm. which is love, you know? And so he always tried to, you know, mention that about like jiu-jitsu, and then just in life in general, it's like, you know, or you should gauge, you know, your devotion to things by agape, like how
your
much are you,
to suffer
yeah,
for
your
it.
Willingness to oh. suffer for it. Yeah. You know, that kind of shows
I like that
you.
A lot.
Yeah. 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 He's always had some dope, always dropping dope knowledge on the class.
Just kind of that moment after class. Yeah. After everyone lines up.
Yeah. 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 But yeah, agape. That was always that was stuck with me. Huh?
Is he Greek?
No, he's Filipino. He's Filipino. Yeah, but I think it's because I think they use it a lot in like Catholicism, I think the same, I think, cause I think there was, I think he also took it because like, I could be completely wrong, but it, like, I think they use it also interchangeably, like with the love of, like God or something like that, you know, like that. But he always used it with us with, in that sense of your willing, the will, the whole idea of this, whatever, if you're willing to suffer for something, like that's love, right? Like, right, it's like, right, you're sacrificing your well-being, you know, for something, or someone else, you know, it's like, okay, well, maybe that's, this is a good definition of love, you know? Yeah.
I like that.
And so I do too. Yeah.
He would use that to talk about like, jits.
Yeah. Like just, you know, cause it just like, we had a school that it was like the first half of class is like open mat. And we had like a lot of, like when I went in there, like I think I did my first tournament like 2 months into starting jiu-jitsu and I was 139 pounds. And like we had guys in there that were, you know, two plus, you know, whatever. And like, yeah, in the first 6 months I had two, like compression fractures in my ribs just from guys mounting me, you know, cause I didn't know what I was doing and these guys didn't know what they're doing either. And they're just squashing me. And still, so we had it, like, yeah. So we always had, you know, there's like injuries here and there and just like, and then these really long, cause these open mat sessions, there wasn't even rounds. So we would do just these long, like me and
just deep water.
Yeah. We would just go deep, like this, like I think our best student over there, this black belt, Josh Fry, Professor Josh Fry now, right? He would just like, he was like rowing with him is like a treadmill from hell for me because it was just like, there's no round to save you. There's no structure in the class to save you. And he would just take me and just like, you know, kill me over and over again, you know? And just like, he's this type of guy who does like mega marathons and stuff like, and just
very lean.
What's
just,
that?
Just very lean.
He's just so strong. Like I think, David Mitchell, knows him, rolls with that open mat at Brothers sometimes, okay, or used to. Josh was just the type of guy that made Brothers, I think, really good is cause like we had these guys that could just like, there's always somebody there, at least for me, that was going to smash me. There was never even when I was at, even got the high black belt, it was like, there's always somebody there that could give me a beating.
So important to get your ass beat.
Yes. Yeah. I think a lot of people avoid that.
Yeah. I'm kind of guilty. I've softened up, man. What can I say? I got a desk job. I moved my girlfriend in. She's a dime.
There you go.
You know, I feel you. We're getting married.
Oh, congratulations.
Thank you. Yeah, dude, you know, but it's called, lifestyle creep.
Yeah.
And so like, if you,
I'm experiencing that as well.
Yeah. So lifestyle creep is like the phenomena of like, you kind of like get used to gradually nicer things.
Right. Yeah.
Until you look back and you're like, I can't believe I lived like that.
Yeah.
And so probably one of the moments where it first hit me in the head was I went back to visit my school over at Chico State. And you know, back in the Chico days, you could just, you know, Natural Ice or Milwaukee's Best Beer, you know, that real cheap beer, you know, where it's like 15 bucks for the 30 pack or something,
you know.
You know, we just drink it like water.
Right.
And then after I got my job with the state and I started making a little bit more money in my pocket, I started drinking Sierra Nevada. Very nice, you know. and I liked the IPAs. And the nice thing with the IPAs was you only had to have two or three of them. You had a nice buzz going. And so, you know, then you get used to that.
Yeah.
And so I went back to Chico one day and I was at a little get together and someone hands me like a can of Natural Ice and I take a sip and I like almost immediately spat it out. And I'm like, what is this? What is this? Do you drink this?
It's camel piss?
And I was like, dude, this is what you used to drink just 2 years ago, right? How are you this far past that already?
Right.
You know? And I think the same can be said for for getting better at jits, and then as you get better, there's not going to be as many people that are going to push you in the practice room,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
And then your ego kind of gets used to it, and then you're like, before you know it, you kind of don't want to get your ass beat, 'cause it's never enjoyable.
Yeah.
But it's good for you.
Yes.
It's very good for you.
Oh yeah. I think, you know, more than just the physical point of getting your ass beat, like there's the whole, like, being able to break your ego, like at least or even just seeing where it's at, you know, like I think for me, that was the greatest thing about jiu-jitsu was, it was just like, I never really, you know, like I gotten into a few fights here and there, but I never really gotten to, you know, anything major, like a full on street fight or anything like that before doing jiu-jitsu. And it was always like it made me insecure, not knowing, you know, where am I at, you know, in comparison to everybody else, you know?
Yeah.
And I think what I liked about jiu-jitsu was because I went in there and the first guy beat my ass, you know, like it wasn't, 'cause it's like beating somebody it never teaches you your limit, you know, like that doesn't mean anything especially for me now. Like I look back on it and I'm like, oh, I beat you. And especially if it's easy or whatever, you know, it doesn't teach me anything about where am I, you know, in comparison. If you lock horns with somebody who either, you know, puts you through hell or just smashes on you, then you can be like, okay, like here's where I'm at, you know?
Yeah. No, I mean, I think that for me, I feel like personally I have the most to gain if I go with someone that's like a little bit better than me, but I still can maybe rise to the occasion and at least make it competitive.
I understand. Yeah.
That's actually really enjoyable for me.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Where it's like, gosh, I'm just losing a couple of these exchanges. I'm, you know, maybe I can come back and think about these, you know?
Right.
But yeah, it can be really disheartening when you're just like, damn, I got mopped up.
Yeah.
I got mopped up.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Yeah, it can. I think like that was a benefit, I think, for the school, like Brutta's, where I came from. Like it was weird because it shielded your ego while it helps you
just get used to it, I guess.
Yeah, because it was like there wasn't a lot of new people coming through.
Yeah.
So it was all just kind of like in-house and like your Brutta's, you know, and so you could really get good and get beat without really, like, you know, like you still got your ego, you know, adjusted quite a bit. But I think it does help. Like I bet look over that alpha male where you guys are getting like just tons of new guys and tons of monsters through, like, it's really challenging to just like, especially, you know, like if a new guy comes in, it's like there's always this like, I have to, this is my home gym. I have
this
to
weird.
Yeah, you know, yeah, like
it's this weird. Like,
yeah, yeah, you can't yeah. get and you can't get over that whole ego hurt or whatever. I don't know what you want to call it, but yeah, the whole.
But it's like, a thing. Yeah,
it's a thing. When I think everybody, either, you know, probably deals with it in their own.
What's worse is way. What's worse is they built a There's like two sides to the new gym at Ultimate Fitness now. The new location over at 1600 Folsom. There's like the MMA side and there's this like sky walkway. There's like this like second floor with like a cafe up top and then the locker rooms and the saunas. And then you can walk over and go over to the CrossFit and fitness area. Yeah.
That's awesome.
It's really big, dude. Yeah. It's like 20,000 square feet, something like that. It's huge.
Man, it looks cool.
But that cafe up on the second floor, people are starting to hang out there.
Uh-huh.
And that's overlooking class.
Uh-huh.
And so I was like rolling the other day and I realized that there was like 10 or 15 people just kind of like watching up top. Yeah. Watching us. And I was like, oh, like there's like dudes, like girlfriends in the crowd, and like parents and people just hanging out, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And like, that's really
more pressure.
Yeah, that's a lot of pressure, right? But you know, I think you know it's probably good for that environment because they are breeding prize fighters,
right? Yeah,
you know,
yeah,
and that like
definitely.
That that ability to create like a pressure cooker in there is probably a good
thing. Yeah. Well, you guys, like, you know, exactly. You guys are, the goal is to make people gladiators that are going to walk out in front of thousands of people, you know, like either cheering for them to win or lose, you know, in a very violent fashion, you know? So it's like, I hope they can stand a few people watching from the cafeteria. Yeah, for sure. But yeah, it's still there, man. At least for me, it is. I know there's like, I don't know if there's ever conquering your ego, but like, I think being aware of it and acknowledging it and still going forward, at least for me, that's the biggest thing I've gotten out of martial arts.
I guess, for sure. Well, yeah. You know what I like to tell people, is that you learn enough to defend yourself after about 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
And then past that, it's just kind of all life lessons and the people that you meet.
Right. I think there's a lot. I think that's so overlooked, at least in, because I can't tell you how many positive benefits I've gotten just from the community, in Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu alone, not to mention MMA, and then, you know, which are pretty much interlinked anyways. Like, but it's just like I was really, I still am like pretty introverted, like before martial arts and didn't really have like even social skills or much, you know, kind of a nerd in high school, that whole story.
Yeah.
And it was crazy, because it was just like, you get on the mat and everyone's speaking the same language, you know, like we're just all doing jiu-jitsu. And then it's like, that's like, for me, that was like, I didn't need an icebreaker. I didn't need anything like that. And then it's like, I got my respect just from doing jiu-jitsu, you know, like, right. And then it was like, and it was so much easier to connect with people in that environment for me, you know.
Right. And then you're able to use that as a springboard to relate to people in other aspects of life.
Oh yeah. Like, and there's so many, like, man, I have so many like friends from like differing views, like religiously, politically, whatever. But it's just like, man, jiu-jitsu is just so unifying. I feel like it's so much stronger than that. You know, I don't know if it's just jiu-jitsu or martial arts in general, right? It's always led me to the positive in everybody.
Like, yeah. I mean, I think the martial arts where sparring is a regular part of it is what's going to bring people together like that.
Yes. The real martial arts. I don't know what you want to call the
other stuff.
Traditional. I guess they're always calling traditional martial arts. I don't know, man. I have no idea. That gets undone.
There's a big market for that stuff. Yeah.
It's crazy because
those Sistema guys.
Oh, what is that about?
It's like the Russian martial art, but they're kind of like,
it's new too. How is this like? Don't they have the internet out there?
Yeah,
you know, like, God.
And then like the, you know, the Ball of Chi.
Oh yes,
dudes are still doing their thing. They're going hard, man.
Hey,
I follow one on YouTube just because he does a really good job of like speaking to the camera and like he's like really
right,
like engaging. And so I'm kind of trying to like learn.
Right. Yeah.
You know what I mean? Because I mean he can't be. Like, what he's doing isn't all wrong. He's making a living off of this, you know what I mean? And he's a good instructor, like, insofar as people are believing his shit, you know?
Right.
So I follow him on YouTube, and dude, he's doing like online coach. His whole thing is like, you can like sync your chi and then harness it and then like throw it at people, you know? Like a Hadouken.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah, but he's going strong, man. Dude, he's doing, I just saw a thing, he was in Prague.
Uh-huh.
You know, he had a bunch of dorks in Prague pay him like $125
dude,
like
you know, I picked the wrong sport then, man. Right? Screw all this school, screw all this honor and friendship stuff. I want to sell balls of chi online.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's the sort of thing where it's like you know, I'm surprised more anthropologists don't study that as a way to like peer into closed communities,
cults.
Yeah, cults. They're cults, right? I mean, like,
Because it doesn't work.
Because it doesn't work. If I tell you I'm going to throw a ball of chi at you and and I need you to like act this way, and then like other, there's like doctors and shit going to these things and they're like, you got me, you know, like I'm frozen.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, that's a fucking cult.
Yeah,
you know?
Exactly.
And it's not long before, you know, it's not, that doesn't, I think, do anything to bring out the positive aspects of people, and it doesn't do anything to bring people closer together.
No, it doesn't.
Taekwondo is an interesting one, because a lot of times those folks don't spar that much, but you know, if you're just doing the forms and learning movements and stuff, like that's not so bad. Like you can learn about hard work and dedication and stuff.
It's because, like, man, I've definitely run it. Like one of my MMA instructors was a Taekwondo guy, and then he transitioned to Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu and MMA and stuff. And man, he would just like, I mean, he'd light me up. Like,
I'll bet,
kicks just in. So it's like,
but he was probably sparring.
He sparred, I don't know. It was in some Taekwondo place in Georgia, I think. Shout out to Rusty. But he could kick me at such weird, cause you get used to like where things are capable of hitting you from.
Yeah.
And then it's just weird when you meet a guy who just, he's hitting you at angles that you're totally not used to. And that totally, like, it opened my eyes to one, like, you know, I should be more open-minded, you know, cause like, there's good things. There's like, even in the traditional martial arts, there doesn't mean, even if they have a cult mentality, it doesn't mean that there's things
within them that can't be useful.
Thank you. Yeah, exactly. You know, like look at Anthony Pettis. You can't argue with
that guy.
Yeah. So it's just like, it's hard because I hate seeing, people that claim that they're martial artists and maybe they teach one or two good things, you know, like, but then they spew all this other stuff.
Yeah.
Like it's
just,
and like
the rest is bullshit.
Yeah. You know, and then there is this weird, like, cult like worship. It's not even a cult, it's like worship the head dude, you know.
Yeah, like a living deity.
Yeah, almost. You know, yeah. Like it was so, I taught at UC Davis at the Experimental College. It was supposed to be this place where students would just come and they would set up, like they propose any class basically, and then they would teach the class. And so a lot of the classes that were taught were actually martial arts classes. They were all taught, all these martial arts classes were just taught by like these outside instructors. They weren't students or anything, but like it was like Aikido and Hapkido and stuff like that. And then so I'd been desperately trying to get a club going at UC Davis where you could actually grapple. And man, like they tell you like during enrollment, like, oh, we have all these great opportunities for students to start this and that. But then when you go and actually try, man, they bog you down with so much like bureaucracy, you know? So it was really, really difficult to get a club, a jiu-jitsu club going where we could actually grapple. Because they were like, well, we need people there for safety and liability and like all this other stuff.
But
we
don't have that.
Yeah.
Stop it.
And so,
no, you don't.
Yeah. So I went to the Experimental College and they were great and they gave me the opportunity. But then it was just like, it was so hard dealing with the egos of these other martial arts.
Like Aikido dudes?
Yeah. And it was nuts. They're because, like,
well,
like,
that would never work. I would grab your wrist.
Oh, dude. It was like I walked in one time, because I left my gi in the back, and they were doing, it was one of the classes. I don't know what it was. It's like the dude had like the long, like it wasn't like a regular gi. It was like the one with the long, like skirt thing.
Oh, the black skirt.
Yeah. I don't know what
it's like
it
the
is.
The samurai gi.
You know, and he's just standing, and he's a scrawny white dude, and he's just like, okay, you guys, are you ready to learn a new move? And everyone was like literally like groveling. It was weird. Yeah. Yes, sensei. Yes, sensei. Like just all like that, right? Yeah. And it was just so bizarre. Yeah. And he was like, I don't think you guys are gonna learn a new move today. And just all this like,
just being a dick about it.
Yeah, like and it was almost like, I think there's this thing that happens where people, they perceive like the martial arts movies and the whole culture where the sensei is like this strict dick, and for some reason like that's going to advance you as a person, you know, like if you just grovel to this dude, like he's going to make you into Jackie Chan, you know, yeah. like there's yeah. like,
when in reality, it's not good for you at all.
Yeah. Where it's like in reality, he can't fight. He can't defend himself, you know, like,
and even if he could, that's not a good structure for bringing out the best in martial arts.
Exactly. Yeah, absolutely. 100%. Exactly. Cause and so it was just, and then it was just weird because like he'd go and meditate and I'm it like with like one of his students and I'm like, they work so hard to produce everything but the martial art, you know?
Right, right.
It's the whole, they have the costumes and they have the different katas and all, but and the like
meditation, the yeah, flexions, everything. They got some Japanese shit on the wall.
Yeah, exactly.
No,
you know,
no actual fighting.
Yeah, exactly. Absolutely. Yeah. So that's like, that it's very frustrating because it is, like you said, like it is very intelligent people usually that go, that seem to like, they drift towards these traditional martial arts. So, and it, yeah. Oh, go ahead.
Well, no, there's, so I'm around a lot of light. So I've been at the legislature for like the California State Legislature for like the last 6 or 7 years.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. So it's been a lot of fun. It's been a wild journey. I've been incredibly privileged to work with a lot of woke people, you know, just like really enlightened people.
Right, right.
One of the narratives that I've been recently been, no, not narrative. One of the things that I've been recently becoming aware of is this notion of like, exoticization in particular with like Asian cultures,
right? Like it's Orientalism.
Orientalism. Right, yeah, basically yeah, Orientalism, yeah.
Right?
Like,
right.
Oh, like, oh, so, and they do that. They, you know, folks tend to do that a lot with women.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
Oh, you know, the Asian women, like right. they take care of you. Yeah. You know, all that bullshit. Right.
Right. Right. Right.
And like, you're kind of, attributing to people and to objects qualities that they do not have or that you cannot like rationally say that they possess
right.
simply because of where they're from
right,
and because
right.
it's different than your own.
Right,
right.
Of course.
And, you know, sometimes it's kind of like, not even well-meaning, just disgusting. Right. Like with, yeah. Like with what a lot of folks do to like, you know, like Asian women, uh-huh. you know, they just kind of like, oh, Asian women take care of you. You don't know that. Like,
right. Right.
Yeah. Every one of them is an individual person, you know?
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
Or like, you know, they do it with models too. Like, oh yeah, we want like a Asian, like a Cambodian looking girl with mystique, you know, like, yeah. you know, they're just attributing things to people from that culture because they don't know any better, right?
And yes, yeah.
I started kind of thinking about this with regards to martial arts, and I think there's some like Orientalism and there's some like exoticism going on with the way that people revere these old school traditional martial arts.
Mm-hmm.
And they're like, oh yeah, because it's like ancient Chinese, I'm going to like get in touch with their secrets.
Right.
It's like, well, no,
yeah.
no, like you're, no. you're kind of like fetishizing Chinese culture and you know, you might even mean well, you might even mean to revere and pay homage to Chinese culture. But what you're actually doing is you're in the process of like suspending your rational disbelief in order to adopt these new views on a culture that is not your own.
Right.
And
right.
whether those views are positive or negative, what you're basically doing is, agreeing to believe to a particular belief about something just because it comes from a culture.
Right.
You know,
yeah.
like there's not people lining up to like learn the ancient secrets of American boxing.
Yeah.
Like it's just American boxing.
Yeah. Yeah.
You
yeah.
know? And so I think that the well-meaning, you know, the, especially particularly the white folks that find their way, you know, they're paying like top dollar for these Tai Chi, you
right,
know, for
yes.
these Tai Chi gurus.
Yes, yes, yes.
It's this weird strain of, you know, they really think that they're going to get some sort of like, you know, connection to some sort of like almost like mystical force, yes, you know?
Right.
And it's too bad.
They've, they spiritualized like their martial arts, like where yeah. it's like, yeah, you can get in touch with some power.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. And really, I think that, not to go too far deep down this rabbit hole, I want to talk to you too, but, man, I was on this camping trip my fiance now, Haley. And there was these two gals at the campsite next door. And so we, you know, just right next to that, the plot next to us. And so we start just talking, you know, pretty soon we go over there, we bring some beers over there, and we just have like a great conversation for a couple hours.
Mm-hmm.
with these two gals who are camping by themselves. Lovely, lovely people. It's a shame we all didn't stay in touch, but one of the things that struck me as kind of odd was that this, you know, one of the women that was on the camping trip, of the people that we had met up with, she was just going through this like phase in her own life where she was getting like really into her Thai heritage.
Oh, okay.
And yeah, she was like learning like the Thai language and learning the writing. And she was like reading all these Thai like little proverbs and trying to understand them in their original Thai. And she was like, oh, you know, she looked into it, was like, oh, my family, they were warriors. I have warrior blood in me. And you know, she was like getting all mystical about the whole thing. And she had like an elephant tattooed on her. And she had like a big trip to Thailand, you know. Back or, so, you know. And like
very Thai.
That's like the Thai symbol for tourist, right? It's like the elephant tattoo. Yeah. But you know, she was what I saw in her was this like she was like trying to make that hair like people that came before her were warriors. That does not make her a warrior. Yeah. You know what I mean? Like, it doesn't like make, it doesn't change. I think it doesn't change a thing about her.
No,
you know,
it doesn't.
I think you can like be proud of your heritage. Like, hey, isn't it interesting?
Yeah.
But it's like the one thing that you don't control.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's literally the one thing that you have no control over. Right, but you know, people want to, sort of spiritualize it almost, you know, like
of course,
like oh, I come from like
yeah,
I come from German knights, we were, you know, we were strong people, you know?
Exactly, everyone wants tribe, they always, everybody wants to be in a group where they can claim some kind of divine heritage or divine, like it doesn't have to be divine, but just something special that they don't, that you know, like special by birth, basically, you know, like it's
weird. So yucky.
Yeah, it is, because I think it's like in there is, it is a like a, what's the word, fetishization
it of is,
because it's like instead of working on improving yourself and like as an individual and you know, trying to better, I don't know, society or something, you're focused like, you know, on on just your past to make it like not even your past, just a bunch of other
collective
people's
past.
Yeah, this collective past, and you start learning history and all this stuff about it, which is good. But like, what's the purpose? It's all like to make you look better. It's like, okay, like you're that, I don't know. It just seems very, like selfish.
Yeah. This was actually a huge strain. This was actually a huge source of strain between my family and I. You know, because we were Mexican immigrants. I was brought over here. You know, my first memories were on this side of the border. Mm-hmm, and so I eventually became a citizen, but before my 18th birthday. But, you know, for my mother and father, they were kind of like reluctantly American. They just came here for the opportunity, but they really didn't, you know, I think for folks from that generation in Mexico, there's not a lot of love lost for America. Mm-hmm. You know, there's an old saying, you know, we didn't cross the border crossed us, Texas and New Mexico. True, right?
Yeah.
And so there, you know, there's kind of like almost like this feeling of resentment, you know, for the wealthier neighbors up top. And now we have to like leave our homeland and go there. And so, you know, I think my parents wanted to create this like cultural enclave where we really just hung out with other Mexican families and only the family. And I was I don't know, guys, you guys brought me here at a young age. I speak English well. I'd like to learn to surf and make the friends I make as I will, you know?
Right.
And like, oh my God, it was like this big thing. Like, oh, you're turning your back on your culture. And I was like, what's this culture thing? Like, that's literally the one thing you can't control is where you're from. Like, what sort of sense of pride is that? It's interesting. It's beautiful.
Yeah.
You know, and there's wonderful like life lessons there.
Yeah.
But I'm not going to deliberately create a group of people based on their race.
Yeah.
You know, and I honestly get kind of,
that's where it gets messy, right?
Yeah. I get kind of suspicious of people where like, whether it be like, you know, white people that only hang out with other white people. Mm-hmm. Or like, you know, Mexicans that only hang out with other Mexicans, or African Americans that only hang out with other African Americans. Like, why don't you, like, why did you go out and deliberately create this, like, this group of people that all look like you? Like, what sort of, like, you know, insecurity is this, you know?
Right. Yeah. I well, God, I've heard a lot of stuff recently kind of like on the whole like idea of like, yeah, like tribe, right? Like,
yeah, it's like what we're dealing with right now.
Yeah.
Collectively.
Yeah. And so it's just like someone pointed out, it was interesting, like the different, like Brazil had a really terrible, history with slavery. Like a lot of people even argued that they were comparable or worse than even the U.S. slavery.
No, wow.
But they were saying like a big difference in Brazil. And I could be getting details wrong, but
Cliff Notes version here.
Yeah, exactly. Right.
Allegedly.
Right. Yeah. Right. Exactly. Like they're saying that the difference is like in like the Portuguese in Brazil, like sent over mostly just men. And so there was more intermixing of people there, whereas in the U.S. it really stayed sexually segregated, you know. And now we're still, I think, we're still
dealing with that.
Yeah, still these race issues are constantly coming up, you know. And it is weird. It is weird. Like I saw. I think like it was like a Vice or something on, or a Journeyman thing on like how Koreans they have like when they have like communities of like you'll see in like Davis there's a Korean church and there's you know, and I even see like a Chinese church and stuff, and like mm-hmm. you know, you go to like San Francisco you see like Chinatown and stuff,
right,
you know,
right.
Like, and there is this like, and it makes sense, right? Like you want a community that can speak your language and hopefully make you more successful, you know, in a new place, right? And so to that extent, like I think that's super beneficial. But like I think what like you were talking about, where it becomes bad is like if you're only staying with that tribe, if you're like this is it, you know. Like I think a big problem I had with jiu-jitsu is like I just didn't venture out enough, you know.
I'm starting to feel that way too.
Yeah, you know, like god, I kicked myself like so like Mario, do you know Mario Soto?
Oh yeah.
Yeah, so
I mean, he's like, got to come on actually. I love the guy.
Yeah, he's like, yeah, I went to school with him actually.
Did you really?
Yeah, in Davis. But he was at Brudda's like when Alpha Male first like got made, and then he jumped over there. And like, and I always like kick myself because like he invited like, oh, you guys should come check it out, you know? And I always kick myself like, man, that like, I could have gone over there, you know, and it wouldn't have affected, like, I could have gone to both. I could have done both, you know? And there was this whole thing of like, nah, Brothers is good. Like, I got this. Like, cause, you know, I had no idea Alpha Male would be, you know, probably.
Would turn into what it turned into.
Yeah. You know, exactly. Right. So, like, it was just kind of this, there was that safety that tribe offered me, like, was also kind of a handicap, right? Because I didn't have to. I didn't feel like I had to go out and force myself to be uncomfortable in these others and make new friends.
And so you didn't grow.
Exactly. Exactly. Right. So yeah, it's like, I think that that can be a similar problem to like what you were saying about being stuck with one tribe.
Yeah. So how'd you get into jiu-jitsu?
I got into it. Let's see. I was 19. And I basically like just didn't have like direction in my life. Like I didn't have kind of like purpose. Like I was just out of high school, and you know, still living with my folks, and like, man, I was like, and I didn't even think I was going to go to college. Like I had like I was like had hearing problems when I was really young, so like all through school
that can lead to you being told you're like dumb at a young age,
yeah,
which is not good.
Yeah. And that was it sucked because
you're not actually dumb.
Yeah. Like I
just have like this one small issue.
Exactly. And, you know. Yeah. And so like I did the whole like tubes in your ear type thing. And it basically, it was like just this little hiccup where I couldn't read. And so like in elementary, great, thanks to our great public school system, like anybody who is, you know, like, slower, they just put you in this class where they don't, like, the idea should be like, you're trying to teach them even more, right? Like this kid is
right.
slower for whatever reason. So we need to tutor them and teach them even more. But all through like elementary school, it was just like, oh, we put all the dumb and bad ones in this, like just this, you know, special ed class or whatever, and where we don't even do anything with them, where they just sit, you know, we just sit there
and just languish.
Yeah. And I think I knew, like, I didn't belong there, like, the whole time and stuff. But, like, I kind of started believing that, like, man, this school stuff's not for me, you know? Oh, and then, man. And then, so, like, man, after high school, I was really lost. And, like, I actually joined the Army. But then, I ended up getting medically discharged, during basic, so I didn't even do that right, you know. And so then I felt like a total just loser.
Do you mind telling me what happened?
Yeah, it was like heat stroke, basically.
They kick you out for heat stroke?
Yeah, and then they found some stuff in my medical record that they didn't like, you know. And so, like, that it was out. Yeah, and it was like,
because they don't want to pay for that down the road.
Yeah, probably, and it's like, I think I'm not really sure. You know, like, I tried to do the, like, National Guard and stuff, and they couldn't get me. And then, you know, I was, yeah. So anyway, I was just kind of lost at that point, you know, and I always been in the martial arts, you know, always love, karate and stuff, did Shonryu karate for 5 years, and just, I loved it. And it was like probably for all the same, oriental reasons, you know, like,
he didn't know,
but that. Like, it was good because, like, I had a really good instructor who, like, taught me, like, about the history and stuff, and he was like, he was Okinawan himself, and so he really taught me, like, he, like, broke, like, because, like, we would have questions like, oh, is a ninja a black belt? And then he would, like, explain, like, you know, like, Okinawan, the Shonryu is like, you know, it was designed to fight the Japanese. Actually, it's like, it's a Japanese, like, the Japanese actually kind of appropriated karate, but it was actually to fight the colonizer, which was Japan, you know, at the time.
Interesting.
And so he was always giving me cool stuff like that, and gave me, I think, a real good sense for discipline and like how to work hard physically. And oh god, I'm getting into this long story.
Okay. That's fine, we got time.
But anyways, like, I looked up Brazilian jiu-jitsu one day, just with my buddy Brandon, who like, I think he just got done with, like, he was in the Marine Reserve, and he was like my best friend since forever. And he's also a black belt too from Brothers Now. And we started on the same day.
Oh, wow.
I just looked it up.
You just, like, went through it together.
Yeah. And the first day, like, I just got smashed.
Man, you guys just went through the journey.
Yeah.
That's so cool.
First day, I was like, I'm signing up for all these classes, every single one I can. And I did. And Brandon did too. And then it was like this awesome, between me and him, was so great because, like I knew that, like, if he wasn't there and I was there, like, I'd be getting a little further to him, you know. And so
it was like competitive,
but friendly. Yeah, it totally, like, and I was always trying to just, like, I remember the first day I got in there, and like, everyone beat me up, and I was like, but I could see immediately, like, because there was this little dude, Danny, who's just a badass, right? And he was just flying on all these bigger dudes, just jumping, like, just beating them up, arm barring them left and right. And I could see right away, like, okay, this is it. Like, this is
possible to be an actual badass. Yeah.
Like, this is, like, the whole idea of martial arts is to give an advantage to somebody without a physical advantage, you know, like, through technique. And boom, there it was. It was like,
Danny. Poof.
It was just like, here's this little dude just whooping on all these fools. And, you know, like, I was like, okay, like count me in. So I just jumped in, and I went to every class. I don't think I missed a class, like, the first year I was there, and I just started eating it up, you know?
Yeah. Like, thinking about it before you go to bed
just a total obsession. And then it just, like, it kept getting to, like, then I started I wanted to pick up Muay Thai, so I, like, went to, like, Andy K's place at the time. It was on, like, Northgate at the time, I think. I don't know if he's
it's not Niavarone, is it?
What's that?
Niavarone?
No, Andy K. He actually taught Uriah.
Oh, wow.
Like, back in the WEC days, he was, like, Uriah's Muay Thai coach. And so I went there for a little bit and tried that out. And it was funny. That's where like I ended up pulling some people from that gym to try jiu-jitsu. Cause like I was just in such good shape from jiu-jitsu that like even spar, like we, the few times that we sparred there, like I would run through their guys with like no problem. And just off the cardio from jiu-jitsu. And then, yeah, I started training some of their guys for like MMA fights. And then was just like, I think I could do this too. You know, like I'm hanging with these guys and, yeah, so then started doing MMA at like, I was just a blue belt.
Very cool.
Yeah. Yeah. And yeah. And so now I'm just kind of, now I'm a little bit beat up now and just teaching.
Right. So you had
now.
Seven MMA fights.
Seven. Yeah.
Just from Sure Dog.
Yeah. Yeah.
Are you still going to keep doing it? Are you done with MMA?
Man, like,
what are your thoughts?
I don't know. It's one of those things where it's like,
there's more like money and glory in it now.
Yeah. Like, I don't know. It's like I'm dealing with like, so like that was the other thing I think I was still a white belt at the time, but, I got this big dude in a triangle and he jumped on me and he actually gave me a compressed disc.
Oh my goodness.
And so I've been dealing, like, it's been something I've been dealing with like my whole like career and everything. And so now it's been really acting up for whatever reason. Like I've been going to physical therapy and stuff, and it feels like every time I have a good role or a good match, and it's like, I think I can do this, you know? And then it feels like sometimes like the next day it's like, I can't even get out of bed.
Right. You're not sure if it's ever going to get better.
Yeah. And like, so I've been to a few doctors here and there, and they kind of like, you know, they're like, well, it's not bad enough for surgery. They just want to shoot me up with like, painkillers and stuff. And I'm definitely trying to avoid that. So I'm just trying to do like the physical therapy and massage therapy right now. And yeah, I still like, I feel like I don't want to be that guy who says he's done with fighting, but then like in his head or
thinks about it.
Yeah. So I feel like I have something left. I just don't know what that is, you know, at this point. Yeah,
I feel the same way too, actually. Yeah. I feel the same way too. And it definitely wasn't helped by getting my ass kicked on Saturday.
Oh, no, but that's just, yeah, you know, it happens.
Yeah.
As long
yeah.
as you're healthy. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I mean, it was the jiu-jitsu match over at the Submission Pro Tour.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, it lasted like a minute. I just jumped into a triangle. Like, I took my opponent down. I think he was all too happy to go down to the ground, you know?
Right,
and
right.
I just allowed myself to get stretched out inappropriately, mm-hmm. you know? And I should know better. But I think that there's this real gap that I have between where I am in the practice room and my ability to compete on the big stage.
Me too.
I'm like a god in the practice room.
Right, right.
You know, I'm like
a
gym god.
Right, right.
You know? Yeah. There's days in the practice room I'm convinced I'm among like the best.
Yeah.
You know, and then you get me in competition and you know, I'm just not used to it. I freeze up. My parents were in the crowd, my girlfriend was in the crowd, I'm wondering.
No, I hear you. Yeah.
You know, and I feel the same way. Also, I'm a little bit bloated in my weight right now. Like I was in the heavyweight weight class.
Right, right.
It's like I am not really, you know, my frame wants to be like 170 pounds maybe.
Right.
You know. I weighed in at like 208.
Oh, okay. Yeah,
yeah. Yeah, yeah. So, I took some time off of jits because I had a bad back and a number of other issues. And I just did like start doing some like meathead weightlifting, you know,
like
weighted pull ups and weighted dips,
right,
and deadlifts. Right, right. And, you know, and it didn't really, I think, serve me. Actually, it might have even hurt my jiu-jitsu.
Right. Tightened you up a little bit.
Oh, maybe. Yeah, totally. You know, like I'm just not as limber as I used to be.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm also not as strong as like these guys that are truly like, you know, 230 pounds and just like long and lean, you know?
Yeah.
And so I just got out there and I just went out there and I got trounced and it was not at all where I thought I was. I definitely think I'm better than how I performed, but I don't know. You know, I also have trouble with competitive jiu-jitsu. I love jiu-jitsu as a martial art, but, and I need to settle this in my own mind before I decide to compete again. But you know, competitive jujitsu, you get to this point where it's almost all theory. Like, I wouldn't pull guard on somebody in a fight in any way, shape, or form. You know,
right,
I wouldn't.
Right. You're playing to the rules.
Yeah, you're playing to the rules. Yeah, you're like jumping underneath people. That shouldn't be allowed. You know,
right?
It should really be like, I don't know. It should really, I think, you know, if we could like make the rules have it be more like a wrestling match, but you can throw submissions in there, that makes sense. Cause like, I wouldn't want to go to the ground and have somebody, you know, on top of me just cause I have this like hook in their leg. Like that's not something that I would ever want to do in an actual self-defense situation.
Right,
you know?
Right.
And so like, I don't want to be the best in the world at pulling guard and throwing the De La Riva hooks.
You know?
Don't
want to be a butt scooter.
I don't want to be a butt scooter, you know? And so it's kind of like, I feel the same way. You said that perfectly, where it's like, man, I feel like I have something left, but I'm not sure what it is, you know? Yeah. Like, fine, you know, maybe this podcast is what it is. I don't know.
That's a good thing then.
maybe. I was kind of thinking about doing some like amateur boxing fights, or maybe like going to MMA again just for fun.
If you feel like physically good,
I definitely do.
Yeah. Like I always tell I teach like one night out of the week at Half Gracie's and stuff. And I'm always trying to encourage people to compete, and even to do like MMA. I'm always like, you know, hey, you should do a cage fight, you know, just plant it in their heads, because you know, like most guys like walk in there, it's in their head already,
right?
You know,
right.
Like if you try jiu-jitsu, like even their first day,
you were thinking about
it's in your head. Yeah, it's in your head a little bit that like, man, I should do this. I should try to cage fight one day. And it's always funny because it's like, I know it's like, all right, I'm in this position as an instructor, and I'm like, hey, you should cage fight. You know? And it's like,
you got to be like shepherding your people. Yeah, man. You have a responsibility.
Yeah. Well, I'm trying to get some kind of like group together so we can mess around with mitts or something. But it's been difficult to get those guys like jiu-jitsu. And then with all the I think it's been so cool just seeing like you guys competing out there on Saturday at the Crest Theater.
Yeah.
Like that was crazy. Just seeing all of the, like, you're right. It is definitely, it's a sport, right? It's not, it's not like you won't see butt scooting in MMA, like, or I don't know, maybe you will, but you know, at least not right now.
Yeah.
And like, but it's just amazing to see where it is right now. You know, we had blue belts up there.
I never thought I'd see the day.
Yeah. Honestly. Yeah. So it's hard. Yeah. It's harder and harder to get jiu-jitsu guys to go to the dark side, you know, like, cause they have so many opportunities.
Feel it's come over.
Don't you want to hit me in the face?
Yeah, come on. Yeah. And it's also, I mean, for like the top level competitors, there's perhaps just as much money to be made in jiu-jitsu as there is in MMA, right? Like in teaching and in DVD series and stuff. Like, Keenan's killing the game.
Oh yeah, god, yeah.
You know, like he's
done such reason, he's so damn good.
Yeah, he's like, done a really good job of like monetizing jiu-jitsu, you know.
Right
We'll see if I'm ever able to monetize jiu-jitsu. Probably not, you know. So Keith was telling me you've been all around the world.
Yeah, I mean, not all around, but like I've been to Egypt twice and been to Palestine, and my dad's from Malaysia, so I've been to Malaysia a few times, and I think that's about it.
What's taking you out there?
To Egypt. So to Egypt, the first time I went was in 2013. It was a summer abroad trip with UC Davis, and this was actually during the whole it turned out to be a coup, basically a counter revolution. Yeah, so
you were there for the coup.
Yeah, we were there for the coup. So it was like
oops.
Yeah, exactly. We actually got evacuated. Yeah, it ended up being on like the local news and stuff, like UC Davis. Yeah. And
these dumb American college kids don't know what they walked into.
Basically, yeah. Like, it was really cool because, like, my professor there, she knew everything about, she was, like, involved. Because when Mubarak stepped down, I think in 2011, because of the protests there, like, she was actually a big part of that, you know, getting him to step down.
Oh my goodness.
And then in this, and so she knew like a lot of the organizers for this new, protest in 2013. And so we got a lot of like the, like kind of the insights and stuff on like, and it was just wild being there where, you know, like I've never been in a place where a historical event was like happening,
like unfolding,
as unfolding, like yeah. right there, you know, like, and so that was, and I'd never been in it.
It's kind of exciting even.
Yeah. Oh man, it was definitely exciting. Like I was definitely cautious too at the same time. Like,
right.
I felt like some of the other students probably could have been more cautious. But yeah, like it was super exciting. Like there was just, like the night before or the day before like this planned like rally or march or protest or whatever, like Cairo was like, it was just like, it was weird because it was kind of like weirdly quiet. Like Cairo is never quiet, it's always just like
the calm before the storm.
Yeah, it was and then it was just like, because I think a lot of people just didn't know what was going to happen. Nobody knew. Yeah. You know, like people weren't sure how the military was going to act or how the police were going to act or how, like the, if there was going to be clashes with, like so like after Mubarak stepped down, they had elections and they elected this, guy, Morsi, who's supported by the Ikhwan, the Muslim Brotherhood.
Okay.
And, but a lot of people were really, they weren't satisfied with him. Like, and so a year goes by and they organized another protest, you know, like similar one that they did to get Mubarak out, this time to get Morsi out. And when they,
is this referred to as the Arab Spring?
This was like part of, cause like the Arab Spring,
it was like a broader regional
exactly.
thing.
Yeah. Like, yeah. Cause like the Arab Spring really like, it was in like Tunisia, started in Tunisia. And then this kind of like, yeah, it sparked.
It was caught up in that wave.
Yeah. Like everyone kind of started realizing like, this is my reading of it, right? Is like because of like the power and the connectivity of like the internet, this ability to mass mobilize and was really found, I think, in especially in Egypt at the time, right? Like a lot of the authorities didn't really understand even like Facebook, like how
powerful it is.
Yeah, how these protesters were communicating, you know, all like just like this, you know, and like, and there was, I even went to this thing when I was over there talking about how like Twitter was a more reliable news feed than like some of the news agencies there, just because, you know, like you have like one or two cameramen around and then you have a million people with phones, you know, all reporting,
right.
you know, stuff. So that was a big part of the movement in Egypt and in Cairo. And unfortunately, like when I was there, this basically ended up being a coup where, the military basically took over again. And it was kind of at the, it was like a counter revolution, right? Because it was like, the military was the same group that Mubarak was basically part of, like Sisi, who became the president after they basically jailed Morsi, you know, who was democratically elected.
He just came and took it back.
Yeah, he just whoop, you know, and it was, it sucked because it was like when Mubarak stepped down, it was that was totally peaceful, you know, but then it sucked too because like, because it was peaceful, those actors that were, you know, like a lot of people were saying were leading Egypt in a bad direction for years and years and years, were just still there, you know. And so like as soon as there's this power vacuum, you know, people weren't happy with the new, with Morsi.
They just came back.
Yeah. They just waited and, here's our time, you know, and then they come, no one's there. There's no other military or anything there to kick them out, you know, so they just kind of waited, you know, for, and didn't take them long, a year.
Wow.
Yeah. So, And then the second time, and so it's, yeah, we were evacuated like after like 2 weeks of being there, you know. And then the second time I went a year later, it was with the same professor. Like her and I really kicked it off, like hit it off and stuff. Like I ended up taking a bunch of her classes, and she'd be great for your other podcast, I think. But she really like we had these awesome discussions and stuff. And then she was like, oh, you should try to like, let's try to get back over there. And we, so I applied for this, Bloom grant, which was basically like, you're proposing, like to, how are you going to help a community out, you know, like a lot of students who were helping communities out in Africa and in, even parts of like the US like that that were neglected and stuff. And so I was like, okay, like professor Rodwan told me about Emangiat Nasser, which is from my understanding, it's basically, it started out as the dump of like Cairo basically, but because of the poverty in Cairo, there's no jobs, right? So most people would make a living through recycling. They started finding that, we can try to live somewhere else. We don't have any money to live in Cairo. And so we'd have to go in, you know, and then get the recycling and then go return, or we can just, you know, build
around the
city. Yeah. And so they built literally a city in the dump, you know. And it's like, it's nuts because I don't think that the government provided any of that infrastructure. I think it was all basically done through, you know, individuals and I think like private in different companies or something. But it's pretty remarkable. Like it is a little town, like within, you know, like, no, it's not little. It's like, I think it's like a million people.
Oh my God.
Yeah. And it's, you know, and there's
right by the dump.
It's like, well, it is the dump kind of like, it's hard. I can't like, I have pictures on my Facebook of like on it, but it's like, it's hard to describe because it's like, there's trash kind of everywhere, but it's like,
so, you know, people, so are, the trucks come and dump the trash.
Yeah. I never saw.
And the people dig through it to look for.
That's kind of the impression.
Recyclable metals.
That's basically the impression I got. Like, I didn't really see, like how the trash was getting there. I know, like, it was really interesting because of both of my trips, you would hear guys, like, and they would hit a bell and they would say, I forgot what they were saying in Arabic, but they were just looking for scrap and they would just wander around and hit and like just bring out your trash basically. And trash, it was so interesting because the second time I was there, we don't even think about it here because, like, my buddy that was there, he was like, oh, Egyptians are so dirty. Like, there's trash everywhere. And I was like, well, you know, like, think about it. What do you do with your trash? You put it in a bin and it goes away, you know, because of our infrastructure. But I guess there's all these problems with like they switch, like, with the infrastructure over there right now. Like they switched, I guess, like, the people that do the trash to this private company. That's not doing it. Yeah, exactly. You know, and there was like the second time I went, there was these constant rolling blackouts and just like, it was, and there was a lot more walls. Like, they put up barriers, like, just seemingly randomly in the middle of Cairo. Like, there's just these big block
walls. You're blocking neighborhoods off from each other.
Yeah. Well, I think so. Like, they have, so Tahrir Square, in Cairo, that's where the, protest, kind of like the center mm-hmm. of the both the protests, like that, it, like the second time I went, like there was military dudes like there always, you know. Oh. There was always like little, there's always this like barbed wire fence that they would open and close randomly, you know. And you'd always see these guys, I think they're called like honorable citizens, and they're basically plain clothes like police or military. And, you know, it was like, it's definitely like, as kind of like just being totally not I never felt like my life wasn't threatened or anything like that, you know, but I really had to think about it, you know, like being like, wow, like if I was Egyptian and I was living under these, you know, conditions,
right, it would change a whole
bunch
of your
notions. Yeah. It's like, I'm just visiting. So I can just look at it and be like, oh, that's cool or whatever, you know, but
and
it's
leave.
Like, yeah, exactly. You know, and, but yeah, it sucked because like the whole reason I was there was, the professor and I were, I'm going to do, basically teach like math and, a little bit of English and like Arabic and stuff at the, with this organization, Nebni, which came out of the 2011, revolution. And this guy, Jawad, he made this initially to like try to get more infrastructure built in Manshi at Nasser. Mm-hmm. and I think in Cairo in general, I'm not totally sure. But, then he started realizing like that's a pretty lofty goal. So he focused in on like building like a school for kids initially and starting there. And it was really cool. It was really rewarding. But at the same time, like it was really sad because, a lot of them that even were, you saw a lot of these kids who were really smart and stuff, but their parents at the end of the day were, they're like, listen, like, there's no future for them with school. And unfortunately, a lot of that was true because it was like, you know, over there,
where do you go from here?
Yeah. There's no jobs, you know, like the only way to get a good, from my understanding, the only way to get a good education with the public school systems in Egypt was if you had money, is if you were able to hire just a ton of tutors, basically. Cause like, I guess like the classrooms are just flooded with people and the teachers like are unable or unwilling or whatever to educate, you know, the students appropriately. And then on top of that, what do you do? You know, like after you got a high school diploma, you know, and now it's like, well, you still have to make money, and what's available is still probably going to be digging through the trash, you know.
Oh goodness.
So it you know, I hope I don't say too much because like I was only there for probably like 2 months total, but it like in my impression, it sucked because it was like you're there to help, but
you can't help.
But you can't help, you know. Yeah. Like it's like yeah. And then it becomes weird because, and then I had all these feelings about it's like it's more for me at the end of the day, you know, that I went over there, you know, it was like more for my education and my experience and stuff, and a lot less
about helping them.
Yeah. Because it's like, because I can't, you know, like, cause what am I going to do? You know, like, like I was like, I really want to go back and I plan to, but it's just like, man, like they had
like, what the fuck
do you do? Yeah. And then they had like, they are constantly having issues with like the government, I guess, where like the government keeps threatening to shut them down because I don't know for what, like because they didn't give them enough money or something like that. And it's just like, it's
beyond your control.
Yeah. Totally beyond my control. And then it's just like, yeah, it's just sad because it's.
So did you, you developed this interest in the Middle East and is that what you majored in or?
Yeah. So I got really interested in history in junior college at Sac City. And one of the professors there, Riyad Bahour, he kind of like introduced me to like, the Palestinian issue and kind of the history of the Middle East. And I realized after the class, man, I didn't know anything like about it. Right. I just kind of had all the assumptions, you know, like all of the, very loose, like almost Oriental, right. Yeah. Assumptions about things. And then whatever information I was like getting on top of that was coming from, you know, this is, you know, post 9/11, US media, which was, you know, like is one-sided, you know.
Sure.
Like, and so it was really cool to learn the history about, you know, especially like Palestine and seeing you can start picking apart historically where like politically we were involved or things went wrong, you know? And so it really sparked my interest more in the whole area, you know, because I started realizing like I have been going off of assumptions, you know, I've just been going off of assumptions. Like it's like, what's that? There's that author, Naomi Klein. She wrote that book, Shock Doctrine. Right. And I think that speaks to a lot where I was probably at before kind of learning about the history of the Middle East. It was kind of just like, oh, this happened, so they must hate our freedom or something, you know? And it just kind of became this easy assumption.
Like an easy way to explain it.
Yeah. And I don't have to struggle with, you know, gray areas or anything. Right, or
like,
you know,
the morality.
Yeah. And I don't have to be curious about maybe where
it's
where
just
those,
easy.
Yeah. Where those people are coming from, you know? So it was like, yeah, I learned a lot about.
Well, it's like this North Korea issue.
Yeah, exactly.
And it's like, why is North Korea so mad at us?
Yeah, I don't
know. Well, you might not remember the fact that we bombed the fuck out of them.
Yeah, 20 to 30% of their population
was wiped out by us. Yeah, so, they remember.
Yeah, I know.
They remember. I'm not condoning North Korea's
right,
actions.
Exactly.
And it's super reckless and it's like an existential threat to everyone in the world. But for people to just be like, oh, he's crazy. Like, no, they fucking remember us wiping out 30% of their population and they're fucking pissed and they don't forget.
Yep. Yeah.
You know? Yeah, and it's kind of like you're, it's a lot more comfortable, I think, for a lot of people to just be like, oh, he's crazy. And he's
in that job.
I mean, he probably is. Yeah, that's true also. But we also killed 30% of their population or whatever, you know, in a war. It was a war. But, you know, I mean, if somebody did that to us.
Mm-hmm. I mean, God, like what do we say about 9/11? Never forget, right?
Yeah.
You know, so. Why can't that, like, how are we so...
Well, they didn't forget either.
Yeah, exactly, you know?
They didn't forget either.
Yeah, the what was it, the 40s or 50s? When was the Korean War? It was like, yeah, but it's not that, it wasn't that far, you know, far, it wasn't that long ago
that it
happened, you know?
Like, yeah, and like this stuff about the Middle East, man, I guess I know nothing. I am going off assumptions, you know? I really know nothing about it. I know, hopefully enough to know that I don't know.
Right.
You know what I mean?
I think that's and to be completely honest, I think that's where you even end up, like when you do a ton of research is like with this, I think, really humbling feeling of any research, right? Into anything, like whether it be science or history or anything, it's like the more you know, the more you learn, like the more you realize you don't know anything, you know, like you really just don't, like you never have enough pieces to put it all together and to say definitively, like, statements
in, like, a way that makes sense,
right? You know, and so I think it's really important to be able to be where you're at, and at the very least and say it's just like, I know enough to know I don't know anything, you know? I think that's too many people are going off of these like gut feelings almost.
So if you graduated school?
Yeah, I graduated UC Davis with in history and Middle Eastern studies.
Oh, cool.
And then just started, I've been working with Davis Community Meals. It's a homeless shelter in Davis, for like 5 years. So I've just been working there and teaching jujitsu and stuff. That's basically living the life. Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, shout out to Davis Community Meals. If you guys want to volunteer, we need volunteers.
What do you guys do? You guys just cruise around like Meals on Wheels and
We do like a meals program, and then we offer a shelter program, emergency shelter program, and we offer different housing program. There's different housing programs, different family programs. We do a lot, actually. Like our resource center, like I think I heard it's like one of the few open showers and open like laundry rooms.
Oh my goodness.
In like Yolo County or something like that. And so like there's a lot of good work being done there, and not just saying that just because I worked there, but there really is. Yeah. And
so your heart's always been in helping other people.
Yeah. I don't know. Like, it was always with curiosity, because like that's how I got into the homeless thing as well. It was always like, I was always, my girlfriend at the time was doing overnight volunteer there, and she explained the situation about like she's spending the night at this homeless shelter. And I'm like, okay, well,
in case
like,
there's an emergency.
Yeah. Like, it well, she basically like hands out, like would hand out the food, dole out the food and dole out any other help, and then network with anything like during the night in case there was, yeah, in case there was an emergency and stuff. And I got uncomfortable. I was like, what do you mean? Like, you do that overnight? Like, do you have protection? You know, yeah, like all that, you know? And so
I'll come too.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
And I know you're handing out the meals.
Right. Yeah. So, exactly. So I signed up and I started volunteering, and I got hooked too. And it just really, it was again, a lot rewarding of assumptions. Yeah. It was like, again, I feel a lot of times like with a lot of this stuff, it's like I'm getting more out of it than I'm giving. But yeah, it was like I got hooked, like just, you know, same thing happened. I had my assumptions broken. So I guess I like that.
Very cool. Yeah. No, that's definitely, it's definitely revealing. Working in the legislature was sort of like that for me as well. You know, like when you're
at another level, I'm sure.
Oh dude, like, oh, why can't we just fix this problem? Why can't, you know, say to whatever social malady, right? And like people want to do something about it. It's like, why can't we just fix this?
Right.
And then you just like kind of put the word out that you're looking at maybe legislation to address an issue.
Right.
And then everyone that might be affected, you know, comes through their lobbyists, through that. And, you know, lobbyists aren't all bad. They kind of help you figure out how it's going to affect people, you know? Like represent the people that would be affected, and they try to help. It's like, hey, you know, we're not necessarily going to get in the way, but let's do this so it kind of works for everybody involved,
right?
You know, and you just like take whatever issue. You know, they just they're just looking at making like high school start later.
Oh, interesting.
You know, so that, you know, because like kids have different sleep cycles and I things see. Like that.
Oh, later in the day.
Yeah,
like 8:30 p.m. Right. Yeah,
and it, you know, they couldn't get it done. You know, and I'm not going to weigh in on how I feel about it, but just to say, like, you know, you would think that would be it could sound on it. You know, it could sound on the face of the problem. It could even sound simple. Right. You could like state the issue simply and be like, yeah, that sounds great. Why don't we all do that? Well, the consequences of doing that for a lot of people involved are like a lot more complex than many people would think of. And so, you know, I'm convinced the legislature does great work. I'm proud of the time that I've been able to spend there. And you know, I'll probably wind up finding another assignment there again, you know, in the near future. But, you know, it's important to keep it in context of like, you know, you might see something that you were for, maybe not make it, you know, but it doesn't mean that the people who didn't vote for it are bad or something, you know, everyone's kind of coming at it with their own views and beliefs and, you know, they just see the way that it would affect society in different ways, you know?
Yeah.
But yeah, it's the same thing where you're just like, man, I had no idea this issue was actually so complex. Once you start like whittling away at like at all the constituencies involved and how it would affect society. It's like, well, we might need a year or two just to study this, you know?
Yeah. No kidding. And
so it takes a while, you know?
Yeah.
So, yeah. So, where can people follow you on social media?
I guess, Instagram, I guess I'm at Spicy Johnny.
At Spicy Johnny. Cool. Spicy we'll put it up on the screen too.
Cool.
All right, brother. Well, let's wrap it up there. Thanks for coming on, man.
Thanks for having me. Thank you.